kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education Tide, episode 74, A Safer, More Private Internet, part 2. Hi, Di, how are you doing?
I'm good, Doug. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm here in Jersey, so just a bit of a forewarning to you and to people listening. This is a hotel Wi-Fi connection. I've taken my VPN off, which makes me less secure, but hopefully improves the sound quality. If you or I kind of go in and out, then I do apologize in advance for the sound quality. We'll try and make sure that it stays decent, but just context is everything, yeah?
The moral of that story is blame Doug.
Yeah, just blame me for everything. That's the thing. Yeah. Cheers. Anyway, so it's been a while, hasn't it, since we last talked? Was it last week? But it was earlier last week, wasn't it? This is Thursday now.
Yes, we're on Thursday night because we couldn't make it Tuesday for whatever reason. I had reports to do, and I've been very ill, actually, so I've been out of action for 36 hours.
Hang on, when you say very ill, are we talking man flu levels of very ill, or are we talking, like, in the hospital?
Definitely. So boarding schools and illness are quite a funny thing. So, you know, a boarding house gets a reputation for having a bug in it. And because loads of the pupils, or, you know, 10 pupils were missing out of the 60 from the lessons. And so anyway, I think I've got a bit of that. And so I just had a cold in the head, you know, bad head and sneezing, running tap nose, that kind of thing. But I've also had really sore kidneys. It's been a really odd thing. So incredibly achy in the two patches, sort of midway up my back, maybe, or a little bit lower.
That sounds so good.
And that's no, it was really dodgy. So I decided that I wasn't. So what I did, because of my particular situation that I live on site,
yeah,
I could go and set up lessons, start them off, and then leave and say, right, just get on with it.
Because they're like sixth forms and stuff.
Yeah, they're all sixth form, yes. I couldn't do that with the younger ones and didn't. But it just happened that I had lots of sixth form lessons in this particular thing. So
well,
I could just
to be fair, I think that's more responsible than, you know, just I've seen some teachers be ill and slump in a corner and, you know, basically do nothing. So yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? My wife was doing some supply in a very tough school today. On Tuesday. And the guy who I'm in Jersey, and I'm talking to the guy at Victoria College, and he's taking a couple of days off. And we're just talking about, as lots of people have said before, how you end up doing more work than any other profession when you're off. In fact, sometimes it's not even worth being off just because the amount of crap you have to deal with when you get back when you're a teacher.
Well, I think that's interesting. But covers that here differently. And it's all done internally. No, that's not that unusual. You have to cover your lessons. So if I went, when I went to Tibet, for example, which we'll talk about shortly, I had to arrange cover internally within my department. And there's only one other teacher. And he couldn't cover it because he was busy for the afternoon that I needed cover.
Oh, I see. Man.
And then I had to get cover sourced by the person who organises cover externally, as in within other departments within the school. And he couldn't find anyone because it's a sport afternoon. He doesn't know who's on sport and who's off sport. And it's not actually tallied in our administration system. It's done separately. So I had to go and source cover for myself. So I didn't get the email that I was going to be covered until 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was leaving at 10 past.
Really?
So, wow. So I nearly had to can my trip at the very last minute because of that. And it was just really
the whole cover situation, I think, it's really problematic because, I mean, obviously, teachers, given their workload and the stress and the being on stage every day, are going to have times when they need either a physical health day, as in they're not very well, or a mental health day, which I think they're entitled to take. And, you know, my wife has a son Tuesday. She ended up in a really tough school. And she got the phone call at 25 to 9.
Which, really?
Yeah, and she had to be from where we live in Morpeth to Wall's End in Newcastle.
All right, yes.
So
that's small distance.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many of these problems. IDEO, I was talking earlier this week to Cheryl Grant, who I don't think you'll know her name, but she worked at Duke University with the MacArthur Foundation, lots of stuff around administration, around badges, has written lots of articles, did her PhD and that kind of thing on digital credentials and stuff. Anyway, she was talking about working with IDEO, that design consultancy, design thinking consultancy. And it reminded me from what you just said there after speaking to her about the work that they did in LA around the school system and just trying to make little nudge changes, for example, to what the times at which kids eat, which had knock-on effects to other stuff. And it feels like there's so many almost intractable problems in schools when I go into them, which if we all just came together and thought about them a bit, we could solve them together. You know what I mean?
I think that's a fair thing to say. And it's part of the joy of schools, really, is that you get to work in part of an organization in which you have so many people who are, well, no, that's not true. You can do that in any way. But you just get to sort of tweak the organization. You get to make changes. I remember once when my old school, we went from a 1 week to a 2 week timetable, which didn't do my departmental timetable share any good. So I sort of complained about it. And I went through the 36 points, positive points to a 2 week timetable they had assembled. And I just said, and I poo-pooed every single one.
Really?
Like, and properly, you know, well. And at the end, the deputy head, responsible, who was chairing the meeting, the head was present as well, just said, well, yeah, but that's the thing with education. It all just comes down to a matter of opinion in the end. I was like, all right, so what's this list of 36 things for then? Exactly. And so that was quite funny.
It's weird, you know. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but the school I'm working at over here, they're trying to move from a 5-period to a 6-period day. And I've worked in schools, including the academy that I was at, they've tried to do similar things. And when you ask why and question what's going on, It's never to do with, well, we think this is going to be better for kids or whatever. It's always to do with, we need to fit more stuff into the school day.
One of the things that I call is about dilution of quality. So where you have something that's working and successful, and then you make a change of that sort, and you actually end up diluting things. So you just shave 5 minutes off every lesson, or you do something like that, you know. And it's like, well, that's actually going to have a significant impact over time on what's going on. And then,
well, every time you move people between stuff, I mean, we're going to come on to the work I'm going to do in Geneva next week, and I've been planning that this week. One of the things I was concerned about there was that the initial plan was to move students between rooms to do the activities. And of course, if you want to do several activities, that time of changing means that you've overall got much less time to do stuff.
Lots less time.
Mm.
And it's easier to move the teacher.
Anyway, you mentioned Bet just there in passing. So you were there on the Thursday afternoon?
That's right, yeah. So I was there from only a short time because the people I was with had to get away. I was there with a gentleman called Douglas Butler, who wrote the software Autograph and used to run a really big maths conference for teachers.
Okay.
Back in the day, based here at the school and then at some university once it sort of surpassed the school's capacity. Well, I don't think the school's tech needs were actually at that time. They are now, of course, but at that time.
Of course.
So that was really interesting. So there was a couple of hours in the car each way discussing what he saw and what he was there to do. So that was good. And another lady who was there her son is disabled, so she was there to see what tech there was that she could help with her son, who's quite seriously disabled. So that was interesting, but I had a great day. So because I was only there for 4 hours, I didn't go out of my way to see, which is, so I didn't go and see any of our current suppliers. And I didn't go and see any of my friends, which I miss, you know. So I only saw two people whom I know very well, one of which is Simon Finch. He was going to come and join us for this podcast, but unfortunately hasn't been able to make it. So, I hope all is well, Simon. It's a shame you couldn't come. And then who else? I spent quite a bit of time with Gideon Williams, who does my job over in the International School in Holland. And we had a similar agenda, so we spent some time together going around different stands. So the stands I was looking at mainly were about devices, were to do with inking, essentially, which I've talked about before. And it's, did you know that most of the computers in the world are made in the same factory?
Well, I can't remember who I've talked to about this. When I went through the BET program, I saw that there were at least four representatives of Shenzhen there.
Okay.
And given what
you... with these companies.
Yeah. So, given what you'd said on the podcast last time, you know, about like, oh, they're all made in the same place and it's basically just marketing and pricing that's the differential. It did make me think whether that's going to happen sooner than people think. You know, in the same way that at the start of the season, nobody was talking about Chinese football. And now everyone's talking about, you know, the latest star to go and join the Chinese Premier League.
Yes, yes. Well, so there's one company called Quanta, I think they're called Qantas or something. Quanta. Mm. And they make 33% of the world's devices, including Macs. So these factories make Macs and Dells along the same alongside.
Okay.
These companies are just repurposing it. Now, the companies do have some input into R&D, and they obviously put investment in it. So for an example of this is the Microsoft Surface Pro. And so the Microsoft Pen is particularly, you know, it's had a million and millions of devices. One of the things that shocked me is that being released, so not able to buy yet, but being released at BET as this global release, with lots and lots of devices, and they all looked like Microsoft Surface Pros.
Well, of course, in the same way that everyone was aping Apple, I do actually feel, not necessarily towards Microsoft, but I do feel like the balance of power is shifting away from Apple. I've read a lot of stuff, especially in terms of, I don't know, like, you know, the disillusion with the MacBook Pro, yeah, for example. So, yes. So Laura Hilliger, hi Laura, if you're listening, I know you will be. She bought a MacBook Pro without the touch bar, and she said she'd never been so kind of like meh about buying a new laptop, but like she literally had to buy the MacBook because she's locked into Apple stuff. And it feels like, and someone said in this article that Apple seems to have moved towards like shifting boxes, and I think Tim Cook used to be in logistics, that's where he came from. So it literally is about moving things about rather than creating stuff, but whatever.
I did read somewhere that in the second half of 2016, maybe something like that, that Apple had sold, or one of the quarters, they'd sold more iPhones than ever before.
Hmm.
So whatever they're doing, you know, it's working, but it's probably to do with market increase rather than people.
Well, exactly. And, you know, if you look at that innovation cycle, you get the peak, you know, you get the peak number of people buying stuff just before it falls off a cliff. Yeah,
that's right. That's absolutely right. Yes. So it would be interesting to see. But anyway, this was a little bit more particular than that, right? So it was a little bit more like the devices were identical. So it wasn't just that they were similar. Do you know what I mean? It was like they were identical, the same hardware, as far as I could tell. Whether it was or not is another matter, because there's a different combination of, you know, processors.
Yeah, of course. Like, what's in, it might look the same outside, but inside it might be something entirely different. Yeah, yeah.
So looking at that and looking at this sort of Surface model, and Gillian said something really interesting about a Surface 3. So you have Surface, then you have Surface Pro, and Surface 3 came out. I don't think there was ever a Surface Pro 3, but there was a, they released it. So there should, in theory, be a Surface 4 and a Surface Pro 4, but there's not a Surface 4. It doesn't exist. And so these things are very well resourced to do what they do. They had one with a cracked screen and tried to get the screen replaced, and it was going to cost €700, which is the same as the actual brand new unit.
Well, exactly. I mean, these things are now closed boxes. I've mentioned my new laptop to death on this podcast and on my blog, just mainly because I think that buying stuff intentionally is important. And someone asked today, like, oh, you got a new laptop, whatever, how much did it cost, la, la, la. And they said, oh, what the spec is on. And I always max out the specs because, you know, especially on laptops and those kind of things, it's very difficult to upgrade them because these days they do tend to, for the sake of thinness, they do tend to solder the RAM onto the
memory onto. They're made by robots, not people.
Exactly. So, yeah, you kind of have to, you've kind of got what you've got, and that's it, which is, you know, I'm now 36, half my life ago, oh my goodness, when I was 18, I was given £1,000 for my 18th birthday, which I think I was supposed to save, but I ended up spending on building my own PC, which was amazing for the time. And, you know, you built your own thing and you sourced your own parts and it was a bit of a geeky thing to do. Whereas now, you know, no one does that really unless they're really, really into it.
Yeah, so the only people I know that do that are gamers.
Mm, exactly.
I've got one pupil who does that, and his machine is awesome, but he runs 20%.
Mm. So you were there on the Thursday afternoon. I was there on the Friday. So I got the train down on Friday morning. I spent Friday afternoon there. And then I spent, until about 2-3 o'clock on Saturday. And I have to say a lot of people had packed up by then. So I did a few things. Oh, I tell you what I haven't put a link in for. I did a presentation in a brand new environment, which is called Alice, as in A-L-I-S. And I was fully prepared for this to be crap, I have to say. I was fully prepared. You know, like when you used to, like 10 years ago, you'd go into Second Life because it was the big deal. Yeah. And you would do something and you'd think, well, hang on, there must be something good here because everyone's been saying how amazing this is. And you'd spend loads of time in there and you'd realize that there was no way this was ever going to be useful, really, in education for most people. And then there's obviously Minecraft. But actually, this is somewhere in the middle. So I did this presentation, which I entitled Improving Students' Experiences of Learning Through Alternative Digital Accreditation on the Mirador stand. Now, Mirador is a spin-out company from the University of Birmingham, and they're heavily supported by Sheffield Hallam University because people like Guy Merchant, who is the external examiner on my... for my thesis defense, is well into virtual worlds. And it's actually really easy to use. When I was talking to the guys, and this is not an advert for by any stretch of the imagination, but when I was talking to the guys, they said that a lot of people start with what's possible in terms of the graphics and the world, whereas they started with, well, what do people actually want to do with it? So they've got effectively two modes, one of which is you standing on a stage with a massive screen behind you as an avatar, of which you can look like anything you want. Another one is like a gallery area where you can put your slides around and you can have little bubble conversations and do tours and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, you know, I'm going to be doing a presentation to Australia in March. And I think this will be perfect because, yeah, it's got everything you need and it's a bit more engaging than, you know, my face very close up on a webcam. And I love the fact that I could look like a kind of weird Jedi.
I tell what you had to see. So I had a quick look at this, and I've seen the presentation more or less before, I think.
Yeah.
So I just sort of flipped through it and saw the interactive bits and the questions at the end and things like that, and it was fantastic. Because first of all, I thought you were Albus Dumbledore.
Yeah.
In your Christmas outfit, kind of thing, because you were wearing a big red doctoral robes sort of thing. But yes, it was some kind of Jedi affair, and you're very miniature on the screen as your avatar. Which is quite good.
It zooms in and out, though. That's the thing.
Oh, does it? It didn't.
Yeah. Work. So when you start off, it zooms in on you. Then you're in the audience, and it zooms out. So you saw the question and answer bit at the end. So you saw the bit that kind of like spotlights people in the audience, and they've created their own avatar. So they might look. I think most people make it so they looks like them. But I quite purposely in these kind of things on FIFA and whatever make it look completely different to me.
Yeah, of course, that's the fun. Mm. Dressing up.
And the guys who were doing it, Andy and Andy, they had two mobile phones up, so it was being recorded through YouTube Live, and they were pumping Alice into YouTube Live, but they were also periscoping it and Facebook Living it as well. So I had to, it was a really weird, I've never done this before, I had to present virtually and in person at the same time.
Same time, which I thought was the interesting thing. So I did have that feel to it. That's what I thought was going on. Mm. But it was, so I thought your voice was a bit crackly, but I'm assuming that's because you're on a bet stand rather than in an environment like we are now.
Mm.
And so I thought that, but I would.
Right on cue, you're now breaking up.
There we go, beautiful. But other than that, I thought it had mileage. I thought I could see how this might work, and it just gives a sense of presence and people in the room and that kind of thing, and it's quite nice.
Well, I think it's really well put together. It's still a pilot. They're still looking for partners and stuff. Uh-huh. And it's using the Unity 3D engine, so it's built on a pretty solid base. I mean, I was impressed.
All right, okay. Good. I think it might be an interesting thing to see. One of the things, you can imagine how a teacher at the front of the classroom doesn't really want to be recorded and have their lesson put up. But sometimes you teach a lesson that you've taught before, you know the material really well, it's in your zone, you know, you can comfortably. And I thought that would be a really interesting thing to do for schools. It's like if you take a teacher and you sort of say, right, if you're going to do a presentation or a lesson on something that you think is particularly relevant to this, and this might be a, it might be a really interesting way to store it, rather than, you know, going whole hog video nonsense. All you need is the PowerPoint feed, the presentation feed, and the audio feed, and then the
yeah,
rest.
Yeah, exactly. So what it's doing is effectively adding random pacing in terms of pacing around on the stage and arm movements. But even those arm movements and pacing around is more engaging than just looking at, for example, you know, I'm sitting in front of my laptop now in a hotel room. It's more engaging than looking at my face, because I'm, with the best will in the world, not going to be as expressive as an avatar can be in a virtual world.
Yeah, and it's but it's interesting, I would say, on it sort of occupies a certain level of the brain to go along with the audio. You know, so I remember once Dick Taylor asked me, why don't we vlog this rather than podcast it?
It's very Dick Taylor of him. I sat down with Dick actually for a good, it must have been an hour or so at best.
Oh, brilliant. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, but I just don't think that would work somehow for us. Anyway, let's move on. So,
yeah, so I thought that was good. And, you know, yeah, just if you haven't had a look at that, or you, I think they're looking for higher education partners. So if that describes you, then have a look at it. Other things I saw, well, I bumped into so many people. And were you there at the first ever Bet Teach Meet? And I think it must have been January 2008.
Yes.
Well, that whole gang was there. Like, people like, so Ian Usher was there. And Dawn Halliburton, I'm going to miss some people, like Lisa Stevens and Julian Pryor and Dougal McCormack and Leon Sitch and Oliver Quinlan and just everyone. And oh, and Zoe Ross, who's got a new startup called Mind Moose about kind of mental health and well-being. And all these people were there and it was just wonderful. Bill Lord to catch up. So I had a great time. And they've got Camp Ed coming up, which I always mean to go along to and never... You know, I'm always aware.
I signed up for it twice and then pulled out.
It's difficult, isn't it? But, you know, caught up with them for beers. Teach Meet Bet. You know, I really appreciate the organization of it, and a lot of hard work goes into it. But it's been basically swallowed by the beast, unfortunately. And it's not.
I think, I mean, it was always like this, and we talked about this a lot back in Tech Roundup days.
Yeah, we did.
And I think it serves a purpose. If people are into it, that's fine. So my experience of it is I went along every year religiously. Mm. And always made sure I went to bed on a Friday because of it. And then one year I went and had supper with Kerry Turner, Gideon Williams and Nick Dennis instead of going to bed, because we'd found it had just got, there wasn't much sort of to practice on it. We could see something that you could just think, okay, I can use that in my,
yeah,
in my lesson tomorrow or whatever, or next week or whatever. And it got less and less like that. So we went and had our own little sort of ed techie supper while we talked about what we're doing.
Well, I mean, it's the nature.
I don't go to that anymore.
So. Yeah, it's just, I think anything like that, if you think you can keep something, oh, like quote unquote pure and exactly as it is and put it almost like in a museum airtight box and continue just to keep it as it is. Things evolve over time, and sometimes, especially in the world that we live in, things get commoditized, and things jump the shark, and then you have to invent new things and stuff. And I think people are expecting the original type of Teach Meet to do too much kind of work. In fact, there's a conversation. I think Ian Stewart, who now works with Ewan at Notosh, he started off some kind of thunderclap, which to my mind looked a bit like a kick in the teeth for those who organized, like Drew Buddy, who organized the Teach Me to Bet, about like, oh, it needs to get back to being real and whatever. And then, of course, Ewan McIntosh weighed in. But yeah, I wasn't as, you know, I remember them being a lot better, but then I was a different person then. So that's that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And me too. And so after my supper at Teach Meet, which wasn't a supper one, I went back and I still just didn't feel it had the same stuff to offer me. It was very nice to meet Kate Russell, who hosted it for 2 years. Mm. I had coffee with her. That was very much fun. And there were lots of lovely, lovely people whom I'm very fond of and which I missed seeing. But the main reason I haven't been is because Fridays for the last two academic years have been incredibly busy days for me teaching wise. And as I said earlier, cover has done internally. So I have to take my time to be
We'll
see. What else happened a few ago?
So the person I haven't mentioned yet is Ilan Zekiel, and I had dinner with him on the Friday night. Got a couple of free drinks, thanks to Dawn's organisation, etc. So I had dinner at the back of this pub where everyone was having free drinks and stuff. Mike McSharry, met up with him as well. All different kinds of people. And then had a really...
to meet Mike, but I've not met him.
Yeah, so, I'll talk to you about that later on, not a broadcastable thing, but I had dinner with Elon, but then I caught up with Sophie Bailey, who does the EdTech podcast.
Yes. Excellent.
Yes, and she's lovely, and she'd been interviewing the people there at BET, and I didn't quite get, until I met her in person, that she used to be the head of content for BET, until she decided to strike out on her own, and, you know,
That's where I knew the name from. So Sophie Bailey, I associate her with BET from back in the day, so her name rings familiarity to me, but I'd never connected the two either. That's interesting.
Well, if our podcast is just a couple of rambly, getting older kind of guys kind of being cynical about the world of tech, her podcast is like the slick antidote to that, I would say.
Go check it out if you haven't already. EdTech.
Yeah. Yeah, so she's on, easiest way to find it is just podcast EdTech on Twitter, and follow all, I mean, she puts out loads of episodes, is talking to real teachers in classrooms, not just the random stuff that we do. But she whipped out her phone and went through all of the podcasts that she subscribes to. And
there was some...
Sorry?
Any good ones?
Yeah, so... there were a lot of them that we listen to are the same, like, you know, Hardcore History and On Being with Krista Tippett. Those are actually, Di, if you haven't listened to the... Have you ever heard of On Being with Krista Tippett?
No, that's a new one to me.
Really interesting. People from all kinds of diverse fields. I think she's even interviewed the Pope at one point. But, you know, Anil Dash, who... He's now, I think he's CEO of Fog Creek Software, very well known in terms of the tech scene, etc. Just such a fascinating interview about the history of... I mean, so one you could use with your students around the history of kind of Silicon Valley tech, and it's a live recording, so you get the audience involvement and all that kind of stuff. It's really good. And then the most recent one that I've listened to was Maria Popova, who's Brain Pickings curator, yeah. And just how lovely she is and her backstory and some of the way she put stuff is just magnificent. I really enjoyed that. But the one that I hadn't heard before was Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History podcast. Now, it's one of those ones, and kind of celebrities with which Malcolm Gladwell is one, kind of do this type of thing where they'll do series of podcasts. So this is series one, and series one finished at the end of August, which is of course well before anyone knew that Donald Trump was going to gain the White House. And he's talking in that last episode of the podcast, about satire and about the satire paradox of how people like, what's the guy's name off that talk show in America? Jon Stewart? Someone like that. Who pretends to be this really conservative character. Anyway, he needs to listen to the podcast. But what he's saying is that real satire, and he gives examples of really hard-hitting Israeli satire, holds people to account, and it's not just about the laugh, and it really feeds into the fake news stuff that we're going to be talking about in a moment. So yeah, the Revisionist History podcast with Malcolm Gladwell, I think it's episode 10 on the satire paradox, is really, really good. About a half an hour podcast.
Okay, I'm just on the side now, having a look.
Yep, so that was Friday night, and then on Saturday a few exhibitors had packed up and gone because it was billed as being like the parent day, and you know they were there to sell things to schools and universities. But I did bump into lots of different people. I hung out with the GitHub people for a while. Vanessa Generelli, who I knew from her work at Peer-to-Peer University, has gone to work for them in terms of teacher relations, although she wasn't there in London because she lives, I think, still in Brooklyn. So Oliver Quinlan subscribed to the Hello World magazine, of which Miles Berry, hi Miles if you're listening, is now editor, and they're partnering with the Magpie magazine to do that. It's going to go out quarterly, and it's free to all UK educators because of some sponsorship from BT.
Ah, that's very good, isn't it?
Mm.
Well done, BT.
So I didn't pick up one because I was conscious of my heaviness in my bag, and my magazine arrived on Tuesday.
Oh, so you subscribe it to it in the print?
Oh, yeah. Dead Trees.
Dead Trees.
Mm.
Very good. Well, I was sent something very interesting just earlier this afternoon, actually.
All right.
By Amy Burville.
Hello. Was it in kind of plain packaging?
It was not, no.
Yeah.
It was a link on Facebook. And the link is to a Mashable article, and it talks about the hardcore pornography website Pornhub.
Oh, my goodness. Am I going to be able to...
Not safe for work it, possibly.
Hang on. The Pornhub Sexual Wellness Center.
Destination for sex ed, this article is called. So this is a really interesting thing. They've employed someone called Dr. Lori Lechito, a renowned sex therapist, to direct the site and work with a number of doctors, therapists, and other experts to offer advice and answer questions. The Pornhub's VP tells Mashable that our goal is to provide our visitors with a site that has credible and insightful information rather than them having them scouring the internet. So this is a really interesting thing, but it's not saying it wants to be sex ed for schools, obviously, but it's a really interesting idea that they're taking a responsible stance towards sexual health as part of their remit.
It's funny. So it says it's a free subsite. It'll be a go-to resource for some of their 70 million daily users on all manner of topics, including STIs, sexual safety, and how to manage relationships. It's funny, 70 million daily users, yet I've never met anybody who goes and visits porn sites on a daily basis.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, but there we go. That's an interesting sort of proposition for educators.
So you go to your boss and you say, but hang on a minute, you can't block Pornhub because this subsite is teaching all the members of staff about sexual health. So,
well, I'd say in schools that pornography, you know, I live in a boarding school and it must be, what, something 500, 600 boys in our care. And so they will be trying to access One Imagines to as they explore their sexuality and discover their sexuality whilst at school. They'll be trying to access pornography in different ways. And because it's so readily available on the internet these days, you have to question do we have a responsibility to provide healthy pornography for those for that thing?
Healthy porn. Mm.
Well, you know, if they're going to be accessing pornography and that's not our choice, and we, you know, we can advise against that, but it's not necessarily going to have any influence, then wouldn't it be better to sort of say, well, look, this is gender positive, both genders, pornography that you can use to explore yourself with, or whatever. So just a thought anyway. So I thought it was a really interesting thing to see, which is an interesting thing, because the question that is then positioned, are Pornhub trying to make the internet a safer place?
Well, it's all marketing, isn't it?
It is.
And yeah, I mean, it does link to, it talks about, you mentioned this isn't aimed at beginners and it's not aimed at schools, but it does link to this is on Mashable, it links to a New York Times article from last year, uh-huh. which I think, did we talk about this? I can't remember. When did porn become sex ed? And it says that, like, we just let people get on with it and we push things, we turn a blind eye and we push things under the carpet. And I don't think we should particularly go into that now, but it's definitely, if you're an educator, if you're a parent, it's probably worth reading this Mashable article and seeing what you think about it, and also clicking through where it says sex ed in schools to the New York Times article as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a nice segue into the main topic of today, after that extended introduction, which is a safer, more private internet part two, because this will go out Oh, Friday the 3rd. On Tuesday the 7th, it's going to be International Safer Internet Day. And we decided, after doing the last episode on Data Privacy Day, which was at the end of January, that this one we're going to save up all other links we'd curated and collected for Safer Internet Day. So what are you doing for Safer Internet Day, your school, Di?
Well, we haven't got anything. There's no crash timetables or anything like that. So I will be sending something out on the day, which I'm getting my pupils to work on. My digital leaders are working on that this week. And so I'll send out a one sheet and with some interesting links. And I'm going to try and think. We'll talk about the emphasis that I'm going to place on it. But also I'm going to ask teachers, just like you would with International Languages Day or whatever, you'd ask them to speak a bit of French in their lesson or something like that. I'll ask them to refer to one of their links and send some just some stuff I think about, reliability, validity, and bias of websites or something simple like that. But to talk about something connected to the internet and the sources that they might use in their lessons.
Okay.
So their different classes on that day, and send something out to the whole school, staff and pupils as well, which I think will be helpful and have some practical advice. But so the emphasis for what I want to do is to take it away from sort of extreme behavior and when things go wrong, will go dreadfully wrong, like with grooming and such like and massive cyberbullying and things. But to bring it back to more, so it's not getting knocked over by a bus stuff. I'm talking more about just riding the bus generally.
So it's not like, oh, what to do if you think you're getting groomed. Like someone's being a bit of a dick and you want to mute them.
Well, that's it. So it's like that sort of thing. So it's how to help the internet.
Yeah. I think that's a great way of framing it. So I really like actually the tagline they've put for Safer Internet Day, because often it gets framed in like, oh, don't share photos of your bits online. Whereas the strapline for this one, the theme is be the change, unite for a better internet. And so I take that as being, like you said, a healthy relationship with the internet, making sure that the internet stays like Mozilla wants, as a global public resource, not lots of little, like, country-wide intranets that you can't access if you don't live in Spain or Germany or the UK or whatever. Keeping it as a global public resource and something which is a commons. And yeah, that's the kind of thing that I'm going to focus on. Because, like I said last time, I'm going to be in the International School of Geneva, which has the curious domain ecolint.ch. I don't know if I'll put the Google Doc that I've shared with you, Di, into the show notes, but we can certainly talk about some of the things that I'm planning and just, you know, if that's the kind of thing you do or not, and it might just inform some of the things that people are planning to do either on the day or kind of slightly belatedly afterwards.
Cool, let's do that.
Okay, so the structure that's going on, you mentioned that you're not collapsing timetable for Safer Internet Day. Well, they are for years 10, 11, and 12. So that's kind of 14 to 17-year-olds, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the person who's asked me over is Richard Alloway, who we both know from Twitter and various other social media things. Former geography teacher.
I've spoken to you before, virtually, I think, rather than in person.
Mm-hmm. And so the schedule is basically there's three 90-minute sessions for me to talk to years 10, 11, and 12. And I think there's like 72 kids in years 10 and 11 in each year, and then there's 90 kids in year 12 or something like that. Richard said, I don't want you to come and say don't share dick pics. Like, I want it to be like stuff about fake news and filter bubbles and how they can actually act in the world and do something positive and aspirational and not just like feel like it's something that they shouldn't be doing and defensive and all that kind of thing. So I thought I'd take the theme, talk about use some of the resources on the site, but then move quickly on to fake news and filter bubbles. And we'll come on to some really useful links that I've come across just in my normal reading. I think I shared them in my newsletter. But I'm going to try and put in as many activities as I can. And the first thing I'm going to ask them to do is an activity which sounds stupid, but I saw someone do, and I was a participant in it, it worked really well, which is ask them to take a post-it note and draw the internet. on a post-it and put it on the wall.
That's tricky.
Well, it is, but the interesting thing that should come out of that, and again, I'm going to model all this, so I might get my 10-year-old son to draw the internet and stick that on the screen or whatever, but it'll be interesting to see what they draw. You know, will they draw the technical side of it, or the happy smiley face, or the, you know, I feel left out, or whatever it is. And that'll link to, after I've done some input, into what would a better internet look like. And it might be that they refer back to the previous post-it, perhaps they don't. But it'll be interesting to see whether they focus on the technical aspects of it, or whether it's the social aspects of it, which I guess it will be, or what it'll be, you know.
It's interesting. I'm always fascinated by what other people think of when they think of the internet, that, so mostly teachers and pupils. So whether they see it as this illusion, particularly pupils, I think there's. But a lot of people think that the time that they spend online is a waste of time kind of thing. It's like, I don't know, other equivalent waste of time in life. But and they don't see it as quality time like you would, for example, reading a book. You know, people don't say stop reading books. And very often. And but they do say get off your phone or whatever. And it's been interesting to see. I think it means different things, and I'm constantly interested in just sort of checking out what people are doing. So that would be interesting in that, you know, if you were to get, like, on the post-it, if you know, what is the internet? So I think drawing the internet is quite abstract. I think drawing what you do on the internet, like five icons that represent the times.
Oh, that's nice.
Do you know what I mean? That might be really nice. So you get this picture of things, and then you could say...
Oh, that's better, yeah. Okay, I'll use that, yeah.
You could say then on the other activity could be, what does a better internet look like? Could be, what five icons would you draw on a good internet? You know, if you felt that the internet was a really valuable resource, which it is, and they probably feel that anyway, but whatever it might be.
No, I like that. That's a much better start of what you do on the internet and, like, what would you like to do and all that kind of stuff. But with all of these things, you know, the post-it and the bit of paper and all the things that I'm asking to do are just kind of conversation starters. And the learning happens not with me standing at the front or even them drawing on the thing. It's the conversation that goes with it. And I think they're old enough. You know, they go to a pretty exclusive international school. They're 14 plus years old. They should be able to deal with this. And one of the things I want them to do, and I'll see how this goes the first time I do, because obviously I'm doing it and then repeating it twice. But I'm going to give them a short break, and I'm going to say, hey, if you want to whip out your phones or whatever, just go on those. And then later on, ask them what they did. And you suggested before we actually started recording that it might be not just what did you do, where did you get your news from, you know, filter bubbles, but actually, did you check what your friends were up to? How did you do that? How did it make you feel? That kind of thing. Having a healthy relationship with the internet.
Yeah, I think that's... So Safer Internet Day for me is, I mean, it's an awareness thing, and it comes on the back of Data Privacy Day, which we talked about last time. Mm. I think it's... So for me, it is... You can't... So putting... It's like when you ask them to draw the internet, you're going to get lots of globes, possibly, because that's the icon that they associate with it. So people are just going to be drawing pictures of the world. You'll get some interesting things, but you'll get lots of people who are... feeling redundant in that, and really what you're doing is it's not just the discussion that you're starting, it's the thought process that's going on within somebody's mind. It's about them reflecting upon how they spend their time on the internet, and it's that awareness I think that's really, really important. Probably.
No, I think so. So yeah, I'm going to do that. And you know, this isn't completely set in stone yet. I like to get things down, get feedback from clients and things, but then I'm going to talk about fake news, and we're going to come on to this, like I just said, about emotional filter bubbles and how it's difficult to teach information literacy given the current state of the world, and how they're going to choose how to keep up to date with what's going on, and how they're going to, like, almost curate their feed, how they're going to make sure that what they're getting isn't... Because I think when people say post-truth, people put their hands in the air, it's like, oh my goodness, has it come to this, the world's on fire. But we've always been post-truth because, you know, people choose which newspapers to buy, and it's always their version of what happened, and some things are ignored and stuff. And it's just that, but on steroids.
And this isn't a new thing at all, but it's, I think it's amplified or happened more or something, or maybe just as it is with lots of things, is that technology allows us to document and record and many more events of the same happening than it's ever before, because everything is ubiquitous, you know, everyone can get access to everything. And so what am I saying is that there just seems to be a lot more deliberate lying going on by those in power or playing for positions of power, which I think is what we've seen in the last year or two.
Yeah, and it's difficult in this kind of session because it's natural to want to pour all of the stuff that you know and all the stuff you want them to know and can, you know, and the stuff you want them to do into the session. But of course, as we know as educators, if you try and pour loads of stuff into a short space, people end up remembering and doing nothing. So I'm trying to just stick with just a few things. And I suppose I need to really tease out what it is that I want them to know, what it is I want them to be able to do, what behavior change I want. And I'll do that as I go back, because I tend to do this, like do a draft, go back, do the slides, and it ends up being better than it would have been, especially if I bounce off people like you who have already had some great suggestions in. But yeah, I want them to leave it. So somebody leave the session. If somebody said, hey, what was that session about? They'd be able to sum it up in a couple of sentences without going, well, it was kind of about this and he said that and, you know.
And it might be an idea to get them to take photos of their post-its as well.
Yep.
Before they put them on the wall, maybe, and take a photo of another one, maybe. Well, I don't know how you work it out, but
I think that's a good idea.
Their phones used for good stuff as well, which is
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That's the thing. And then afterwards, just to move on, there's an optional staff session. And what I've been asked to do there is again about fake news, but also about the difference between, you know, we've often talked about the digital divide, but really nowadays it's a digital use divide. It's not the fact that people haven't got the stuff. It's more like they don't know how to use it or use it in the wrong way. So I'm also going to weave in some stuff around the difference between privacy and security, like we talked about last week. Uh-huh. But I did write a post a while ago, I think it was the last month or maybe before Christmas now, about different models of edtech integration. I think we mentioned on this podcast, but I'm just going to spend some time. And again, it's all about discussion and about local context and color and how they're likely to apply these things rather than someone flying in, hitting them with loads of stuff that they should be doing but aren't, and then flying out again.
Yes, I think that's fair. I mean, it's always going to be a difficult thing and a challenge, and you're never going to please all the people. But it's good to have some simple hooks to hang what you're doing on.
Yep. So that's that. And there's some of the things which are I'm either going to link to directly or use to inform what it is that I say. And one of the things I'm going to point to is Mozilla's complete with new logo, Internet Health Report version 0.1. So it's available at internethealthreport.org. Have you seen this?
Yes, I have seen it.
Did we talk about it last time? I don't think we did we?
I didn't, no.
No. So it includes all of the web literacy stuff that I started work on at Mozilla. So it's got a tab for web literacy and what's healthy about web literacy in the world and what's unhealthy. So it points to loads of stuff that's happening, which is good. Everything from EU Code Week to ladies learning code in Canada and that, but also unhealthy stuff around web literacy, about how people can't distinguish promotional content from news articles. And then also at the end of each section, they've got a prognosis about what will happen if we don't collectively act. And the thing for web literacy, interestingly, is, and they've highlighted this, is we need everyone to recognize that web literacy is more than coding. And of course, on the web literacy map, coding is just one part of the web literacy map.
Of course, yes.
But yeah, lots of...
Mozilla site looks great. Is that anything that I send out for safe internet?
It looks like my six-year-old daughter did the colours on it, but never mind.
It's an odd aesthetic choice, I have to say, in their cosmetics.
Can you remember a while ago we talked about there's an emerging trend around brutalism on websites?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like that.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Stark colours. And also the use of the behind text highlighting, one of my least favourite digital tools in the world, but they just did quite well. It looks quite nice in some parts, not the blue part, but on the white it looks quite nice.
Yeah, yeah. It's the opposite of subtle. there's some really useful links that you and I have put in this, and which we'll put in the show notes as well. And I have to say, you know, last time we talked about reclaiming your attention, there's that article by Craig Mod called How I Got My Attention Back. And I feel like that's something which I'll refer to time and time again over the coming months and even years. And then there's another couple as well, which we've put into this week, which is, well, the first one is Medium and the Reason You Can't Stand the News Anymore. And the second one, which is even better, is called All I Know Is What's on the Internet, which is famously what Donald Trump said during the campaign.
It's a cameras thing that you mentioned last week. Is it just going on the internet? Oh, that's okay, as long as it goes nowhere else.
Yeah. Kind of thing. So have you read these, both these posts?
I believe I have read the Medium article in detail.
Well, so the Medium article, Medium and the Reason You Can't Stand the News Anymore, it's by a guy who co-founded 99U. And he was obviously part of the whole media industry, etc. And what he does is he does a fantastic job of explaining to us as people who aren't in that ecosystem but are obviously part of it as readers and on the edges of it as educators, and explaining just how things like programmatic advertising works and how, like, what that leads to, and then native advertising and how the subtle difference between stuff and how even intelligent people are fooled, and, you know, really points things out with red circles and arrows, and it's just extremely well written with useful examples. And yeah, it's a long read. I think it says, what, it's like 14 minutes or whatever, but it's extremely well worth it, because it, for me, it explains all of the stuff that I feel uncomfortable about.
Yes, it's a very good article, and I put this into is it called Readi? I use it, yeah, Readi, which is an app I use on phone and browser to speed read things, and that took 10 minutes. That was fine at 400 words a minute. It was all good. But it's a really, really interesting article, and I read it 2 weeks ago, which is why I was hesitant, I think, when it came out in your newsletter, I think, so not nearly 2 weeks ago. And it is really made of Western business models and advertising and the nature of advertising. It has some really sort of insightful, gentle messages about or gently written messages about what's going on with these things, how it is that they might manipulate the outcome of the news, you know, the actual output, because it's being filtered through these business models.
Should we just pull a couple of things out of here? I mean, one that I just want to pull out right near the start is, it under the title "The Business Model Is the Message," he quotes Mother Jones, which is a magazine, an online magazine. They did an expose of private prisons, which actually shifted government policy, etc. And they quote Mother Jones as saying, conservatively, counting just the biggest chunks of staff time that went into, the prison story cost roughly $350,000. The banner ads that appeared on the article brought in $5,000, give or take. And he says, yeah, that's an extreme example, but there's a massive disconnect between quality journalism and revenue. So, of course, there's a race to the bottom because of programmatic advertising and native advertising and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, exactly. And the race to the bottom is the thing that you always want to avoid. Yeah. It's just interesting. I was just thinking, looking at the advertising thing, it just reminded me that after last week's episode, somebody contacted us saying that they did get promoted tweets on their timeline.
Oh, they did, didn't they? Yes. And actually, when I went, I realized that one of the things that I'm doing is I'm not using the mobile app on my phone because, you know, we talk about...
Okay, yeah. I do. The time.
Well, it is a notification literacy kind of, not literacy, notification, like conservation of attention is what I'm saying. Uh-huh. So, at bet, I installed the Twitter app, because I wanted real-time notifications in case people DM me or whatever. But the rest of the time, which is why maybe I'm a bit slow to reply to you sometimes, Di, is I'm not getting a notification, so I only have real-time tweets notifications when I'm on my computer and I've got TweetDeck opened in a tab. The rest of the time, I have to actually go and check Twitter. So maybe I'm not getting ads because of that.
Well, the lady you replied is called Jennifer Anderson. So if you're listening this week, Jennifer, hello. Thank you for your tweets. And you are getting promoted tweets, as you've shown from your GIF. And what was also interesting is that your settings were different. So I sent you my settings and what they were, and yours were different.
Was she using an iPhone?
We didn't actually go to Device Central. Oh, no, it says iOS app, she said.
Hmm. So maybe, I mean, there are differences between apps. But yeah, I think they're probably just A-B testing people all the time.
I think that's absolutely right. They'll be mixing it up, won't they? So you can't actually...
And why not, when the cost of doing it, something like that is very small? Anyway, so that post is extremely worthwhile. And then the next one, which is already my favourite article of the year, I think, is from Real Life magazine. It's by Roland Moe, who I did have to look up to see whether he or she was male or female. And it turns out he's an assistant professor, I think, at Seattle University. Mm-hmm. Looks like a really interesting guy. So it's All I Know is What's on the Internet, something that Donald Trump said. And the strapline is, information literacy is not the antidote to fake news, because the institutions for teaching it can't be trusted either.
Yeah, I think this kind of summed it up. Fake news is squatting in one building in an entire landscape of neglect and corruption.
That's the bit I was going to quote as well. We're pointing at fake news as if it's the thing that's wrong. And all we need to do is just inform people better. But there's this whole, like was pointed out, I mean, these two things go together, the previous article about what's wrong with the news. These two things go together. And it's just, this guy has crafted this article. And it's so, so well written. It's the kind of thing that could have been, I mean, this isn't a 14-minute read. This is probably a half of that, 7-minute read. But it's the kind of thing that could have been extremely woolly and been a 20-minute read. But he's really honed it and really laser-focused it. And it's really well written.
Let me read this little bit. Critical thinking is at the foundation of information literacy, but those selling it are not necessarily in a position to actually supply it. Ooh, ouch. Mm-hmm. They may be hampered by an inability to think critically about their own practices and proposals. And then he goes on to talk about historical evidence of this, social revolutions of 1800 centuries, etc.
So he goes into history and stuff, and a lot of this is, in all of these things that we're citing, cite American examples, which some of us in Europe don't necessarily get. But he's got a turn of phrase. This is what he says right at the end. He says, information literacy is less a solution than an alibi for the problems ailing education. Solving fake news will only compound the real problem. Without substantial work to subvert the traditional and promote the outside, the feel-good efforts of information literacy will not serve America's promised rebound. Instead, they will signify democracy's dead cat bounce.
Oh, that's harsh, man. This is an interesting thing as well. Again, similar tone. Schools and libraries are appendages of a non-profit.
Sorry, say that again because you broke up.
Schools and libraries are appendages of a knowledge economy. Instead of teaching students critical thinking, they've stoked decontextualized curiosity.
Mm. So I actually quoted this at length, and this is about information literacy. But I'm just going to stick the link in here, and I'll tie it up afterwards. I wrote a post this week which quoted this four times. And I entitled it, Against Mass Consumption of Already Certified Credential. So that bit that you just quoted about schools and libraries not being conduits but appendages, and about how it's all about students' market value being measurable through standardized testing, I linked that to Badgers and said that what we've got is the co-option of alternative credentials by very kind of stayed and institutions who want to preserve the status quo. And so I was trying to do a bit of a call to action there, but it's just so good. Like, if you're reading this, if you're listening to this and you haven't read it yet, just press pause and go and read it now.
Yeah. So it says, one of the things you quoted was, instead they will signify democracy's dead cat bounce. Do you know what a dead cat bounce is?
No.
Okay, so it's a temporary recovery. I just searched it, so that's...
Oh, okay.
A temporary recovery in share prices after a substantial fall caused by speculators buying in order to cover their positions. As in, is the recession really over, or is it a dead cat bounce? So it's that's put in reference to...
I thought we were just being metaphorical and talking about a dead cat, which would just fall flat on the floor.
Yes, exactly. But that's it's about a sort of a glitch. It looks like something is healthy and it's not.
Right. Well, so at the same time as this was happening, so Roland Moe publishing this thing about, hey, you know, it's not the fact that people haven't got enough information literacy, it's the problem that the whole landscape is just completely shafted. There was something in the Boston Globe about, the title was, Why Are WhiteHouse.gov Webpages Disappearing? Now, this was January the 20th. And people were like, hang on a minute. The as Donald Trump's being sworn in, the White House has removed its climate change website and its LGBT website and all this kind of stuff. And there's all of this like rage. Oh, what's going on? And of course, there's the realization. There's two things going on. One positive, one negative. One is that replacing of websites and the structure of things will always happen when you get a switch between Democrats and Republicans, for example. But the other thing is that, and this points to what the previous article was talking about, is that we can no longer trust, for example, .gov domains, because they're not being run by people who are necessarily trustworthy. And so, as was pointed out in the previous article, that very famous information literacy activity of, oh, look at the Pacific tree octopus, and it all looks very real and all that kind of stuff, yeah, is just a bollocks activity. And also, you're not doing anything worthwhile by teaching kids to do that when the real problem, as I think we mentioned last time, is these emotional filter bubbles.
Manipulation of a situation, isn't it? Mm. The presentation of a situation.
Yeah. And although I detest Trump and everything he stands for, I am equally annoyed, not equally annoyed, I am very annoyed by the constant stoking of very small things by extremely left-wing people on Twitter, and I think we should be saving our wrath and our anger and our action for big things, like the immigration ban, for example, rather than, oh, you've taken down some web pages from a website, like, come on.
I think you join me as a tide representation that we're very much against the idea of what's going on in America and judging people for their religious beliefs and that sort of thing. It's an absolute disgrace, and I think the people living within that system who are part of those that belief, that faith or whatever it might be, or skin colour, or they come from that country, they must be really, really quite physically worried about it all. You know, it must be quite stressful, I think, and it's a real disgrace, I have to say. However, people taking the piss out of Trump, I think, gets nowhere, and I get a bit bored of that, and it worries me. It worried me during the election is people are like doing one-upmanship on Trump by ridiculing him, and I'm not really sure that's the path to change.
No, it's the policies we need to ridicule, not the person. And that Malcolm Gladwell thing I was talking about before, about the satire paradox, perfectly skewers that when talking about Sarah Palin and how Tina Fey did this wonderful skewering of her, but then let Sarah Palin in on the joke, and then it just became pointless. I do want to share, have you come across the work of Darcy Norman, a Canadian educator or ed tech guy before?
Darcy Norman, no, not that I can recall.
So I suppose I've had less dealings with him recently, but, you know, back in the day, he was one of the few who was on Twitter back in 2007. Now, he's written something which was picked up by Stephen Downes in his OL Daily newsletter, and he's just titled it On Academic Travel. He published it earlier this week. And he's just said that, you know, as a Canadian guy, I'm probably not going to be travelling to America, really.
This is an interesting thing. So I am travelling to America in February, in less than 2 weeks, and I am going to go. But other people have put out that they aren't going to go.
Oh, really? As a protest?
Yeah, to sort of say I will be avoiding America as a destination, even though that's, I don't know, was it this article I read? Even though he has friends out there, et cetera, and the relationships that will suffer because he won't go, he's still going to make that decision, politically speaking.
Hmm. I'm just scrolling down Darcy Norman's blog, and the day before, so Monday this week, he has decided to, and this talks to, you know, the global internet, all this kind of stuff, he's decided to repatriate his websites. So he's been with Reclaim Hosting, which I think host in America. And I think they've got plans for non-US servers, he says in here. And they're having a conference soon as well, a summit, which will be in America. But he said that although he's a happy customer of Reclaim Hosting, he is going to move, he's moving all of his stuff back to CanadianWebHosting.com, which is in Vancouver. And I think we'll probably see a lot more of this, actually.
Yes, I think we probably will.
Oh, one thing we should probably mention for those who haven't seen it is that, and I'll have to try and find a link quickly for this, is that Trump has said something to the effect that the, you know, the Privacy Shield, which was the replacement of Safe Harbor.
Yeah, yeah, I do. What's happened?
He's basically just tearing that up.
Is he really?
From what I gather, and I need to probably do a bit more research on this, but what that means in practice is that if you're an educational institution or you're someone with sensitive data, then you might want to reconsider where it's being hosted. Now, a lot of these services say that, and this is what people reply to me, a lot of these services say that, you know, they have non-US data centers and there's no kind of input or output between the different data centers. But still, there's the potential there, isn't there?
I think it's really interesting because the actual the gig behind that is huge. So you're talking about moving Google Apps for Education because then Google will not guarantee that your you know, which continent even your data is hosted on. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because they actually parallel run their data in different countries in massive data centers so that they can offer the most secure and indeed the most robust service out there. Mm-hmm. But so that will be interesting, I think.
So the article, for those reading who want to find the link in the show notes, I just found it there, is called Getting Out of the Cloud. And again, I'm kind of doing this secondhand, so it's not something which I've done a lot of research into and fact-checked. I just tweet out the link for the people to make up their own mind. Fake news. Talking about fake news, there's a interesting thing from a couple of weeks ago now, actually, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it, which, again, you know, might want to use it with students, might want to use it with colleagues. It's entitled, from the New York Times, From Headline to Photograph, a Fake News Masterpiece. And it's a guy called Cameron Harris, a new college graduate with a fervent interest in Maryland Republican politics and a need for cash. And basically how he just made up some stories. Especially the one about tens of thousands of fraudulent Clinton votes being found in an Ohio warehouse. And the actual ballot boxes that were in the picture that accompanied the story were from Birmingham, England.
Really?
So.
Wow.
And he's kind of unapologetic and shows how much he earned, which wasn't loads in the big scheme of things, but, you know, could have swung him and other people, including, was it Macedonia where loads of people were? There was one particular village in Macedonia or something where people are earning lots of cash from this kind of stuff. Yeah, just shows how much it could have swung the election. But again, it's not specifically the fake news, it's the whole industry and la da da.
Wow, that's a really interesting article. That's the best article I've seen about a completely fake story.
Mm. At one point, he said it was paying him $1,000 an hour in web advertising. Which is loads of money as a recently graduated guy.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money for anyone.
So it's interesting. So in Ohio, where he published his story to be in the Ohio warehouse, it's where Trump had accused Clinton of rigging the election. And so people were predisposed, he says, the article says, to believe that Hillary Clinton could not win except by cheating. And then he just played on that that suspicion, I guess. Wow.
Yeah, it's actually interesting, both from the human side of it, because it talks about him and his story and all that kind of stuff, but also from a technical point of view, because one of the things which really got loads of traction was this thing I've just mentioned about the fraudulent Clinton votes, which was claimed to be on the Christian Times newspaper. But it turns out that he'd bought ChristianTimes.com or whatever for $5 at expireddomains.net, so it had some Google juice. And it looked like, oh, well, it's from a Christian newspaper. But, you know, he just resurrected it and put fake news on there.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Are we finished on Sleeper Incident Day?
Well, there's one more thing, which is just very quickly that the BBC has set up a team to debunk fake news, which is good, and that's the type of thing the BBC should be doing. But as we've already just found from the previous articles, it's the whole landscape that needs sorting out, not just, as you see on Twitter all the time, oh, well, Donald Trump said this, and this is actually false, because that's important, but it's not the point. Yeah,
I agree. I'm not sure. They've obviously thought that through and think it's a good idea, but I'm not sure that it is necessarily. Before we move on, I meant to and didn't earlier, but I'm just going to read out some. So on saferinternetday.org, I think it's called, the Safer Internet Day site, saferinternetday.org, that's right. They put loads of resources up there, including things which have some little stats on them. I think stats are always interesting. Images and videos get 8,500 likes and 1,000 comments per second on Instagram.
Wow.
400 million snaps are sent on Snapchat every day. On Instagram, photos showing faces are 38% more likely to get likes than photos without faces. The equivalent of 110 years of live video is watched on Periscope every day. 300 million photos are uploaded to Facebook every day. So a lot of their things that they do is sort of scrutinizing why we upload images and what the purpose of that, what they're for, why we're doing that. And that sort of thing. Interesting.
It goes to show the scale of the audience and just how the world's connected. So this isn't just a... It's not particularly like a Western problem, it's a worldwide problem.
Oh, very much so, very much.
Okay, so yeah, let's move on from that section on kind of fake news and Safe Internet Day, and there's just a few more links which we didn't fit in last week, so which of these take your fancy first?
Let's take them in order. Cuts. Head teachers tell a school system that could implode. Crumbs.
Yeah, so this is... It talks about... Yeah, the thing which really struck me here, and I'd read this before I talked to Bill Lord, who's a head teacher of a primary school in Lincolnshire, and this particular article talks about how there's more kids than ever who need counselling, mental health help, that kind of stuff. And Bill was saying that he refuses to cut that, and he's got quite a few kids in his school, but this is something which he's just going to have to find the money from elsewhere. And I think he's had a increase intake, so he's got a bit of money to keep things afloat for a bit. But some of the stuff that you read about and hear about schools having no textbooks or counsellor or the SEN person's had to be sacked or whatever.
Can I just say that? So there's David Waff, who's a head teacher in Cheshire, and his school has 1,500 in it. He says, I can't afford my own special needs coordinator, so he shares with another school that has 1,100 pupils in it. So that's one special needs coordinator for 2,600 pupils.
It's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah. You scroll down, it's like Helen Longton, who's a head teacher in Haworth, Brighton. Uh-huh. And, you know, she said, you're having a conversation with teachers about whether to buy a set of Pritt sticks. It's ridiculous. And so what, yeah. Basically, the teaching profession in state schools is just held together through goodwill. and professionalism.
Yeah, and the skin of its teeth, possibly.
Mm.
Richard Chandler School, what's he saying? I know that school. Education's at the tipping point. I really do think if we do not sort out the funding problem, the recruitment crisis, within 2 to 3 years, the whole system could implode. Fantastic, dedicated classroom practitioners will just turn around and say, I'm not going to carry on doing this job anymore. Not for this money, not for this workload, not with this amount of stress. So interesting. Head teachers, in my experience, don't talk trash easily. You know?
No, exactly. There's an article linked to the bottom from Laura McInerney, who I think is in both of our networks, and she's just saying, you know, you can see the cuts in the NHS, and they're widely reported, but the cuts in schools are just as dire.
Yeah, there's some interesting schools raised around this. Schools considering introducing 4-day week. Wow. Okay, well, that's just a big alarm call of funding.
Yeah, it's difficult to know what to do about lots of these things. We talked about the Raspberry Pi Foundation before. I'm not entirely sure how new this is, the Raspberry Pi Foundation's digital making curriculum, but I don't think I've seen it before. Have you used this before?
No, I think I do have an inkling of it, and I don't think, do they have to, this was posted by Carrie-Anne Philbin on the 20th of January, so it's not that old.
Yeah, they probably just launched it for beta. There's a PDF version of the curriculum, and it goes through different personas, well, different levels, like creator, builder, developer, maker being the highest, and it goes through design, programming, physical computing, manufacture, community, and sharing.
Has a lot of computational thinking in there as well. What's it called? The 18 months. Then onto the GCSE specification in the last 12 months, and it's going to seep its way down to young years because it's non-computational thought. It's stuff you can do without computers, if you see what I mean.
I'm just scanning, you know, having spent a long time with the web literacy map in Mozilla. I'm not saying the work I did there was exemplary or anything, but some of the trigger verbs I think could do some work, because if I was a teacher trying to figure out whether someone had met those targets, it's difficult if it's can use or use and something or whatever or create. It needs to be slightly more specific, but it's a good start and it looks nice and I'm sure it'll engage lots of people and they're very good people.
Excellent.
Good. The next one is Jose Picardo, who in his latest staunch defense of all things mobile learning has written, "Don't blame the tools."
This is a fantastic article, and people should go and read it if they're involved in schools and using technology. Jose's writing is improves and just continues to improve.
Mm.
And this is great because he's not writing in his first language. He's
Well, that's the thing. He writes better in his second language than I write in my first.
Yes, this is kind of possibly it. But he just talks very sensibly how technology is not the solution for anything. Technology is a tool, and it's always about the classroom and about how you structure the learning process and who's involved with that.
Just to quote a bit, he says, "Using technology well to support teaching and learning is a feature of great teachers. Yet there appears to exist the commonly held notion that digital technology and teaching are mutually incompatible. There's an element of truth about it. It is true that, for example, technology can be a distraction. There's no denying it. So I would understand why you might believe that you'd be better off without it. I might not even blame you. But you'd be wrong." End of quote.
Yeah.
And he talks about how you can counter the narrative of technology being just too distracting to use and all this kind of stuff. And, he wrote this for the TES, and I think he's got a company, hasn't he? With other people. So he's got a vested interest in it. But also, I feel like this is what he actually believes, and it's good stuff.
No, it is what he believes because I know him. So Josie's situation is that he has a one-to-one iPad school. So there's a one-to-one deployment of iPads there, which is not something I would choose to do, but that's what he does. And the company he works with includes another friend of mine called Dominic Norrish, and it's called Educate One-to-One. It's a thing. But Jose is all about what goes on in the classroom and has always been a teacher.
Yep. I haven't seen him for years, actually, but there we are. So, he says, and he's about page up, seeing what he's about, I'm also a coffee snob, a tea heathen, and a cat person. Lovely. Very good. But like you say, a wonderful writer, and I wish I could write as well as he did in English. So another thing, did we talk about, I'm sure I've talked about this to somebody, follow this four-step routine every Friday. Okay. I put the wrong link in here, haven't I?
It is. The link is something we discussed last year, which is moderate screen use boosts teen well-being.
Oh, I'm going to have to use DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuck.
Where is it? No, it was in the Huffington Post. I don't usually link to that, but there we are. Yeah, so it talks about, you know, basically, there's things you should do on a Friday that you don't do any other day. And it says you should block off your Friday afternoon to do this. Now, of course, everybody who writes something has a particular work situation. I'm reading a book I mentioned before about, I'm reading Cal Newport's Deep Work at the moment.
Yes.
So a lot of, it's a wonderful book. I was entirely ready to think it was stupid. And there are some things I disagree with it. But he's talking sense. But he's talking sense from the point of view of being a university assistant professor. Yeah. And it's a similar kind of thing here. It's almost assuming that you can block off your calendar for the Friday afternoon. If you've got bottom set year 9 on a Friday afternoon, you can't block off your calendar for the Friday afternoon. But hey, that's the first thing.
That's what I have. I have double year 9 on a Friday afternoon.
Look at you.
Then I have teacher tech time at 5:30 until 6:30.
Mm. Well, I think this presumes that you work in an office or you're doing some kind of knowledge work which you can schedule when you do it.
Yeah.
So that's going to cut out a whole swathe of people who are listening to this. But for those of you still listening, the second point is spend 2+ hours working on unfinished top priority tasks.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Number 3, spend 1 hour cleaning out your inbox.
Doesn't make that many sense, but yeah.
Number 4, write out your to-do list for the following week.
Yep.
And then 5, leave the office early. So, I'm sure this works for him. I'm sure it's great.
No, I think this is fabulous, and it's all fabulous for somebody, as you say, in a certain context. However, for me, it's not a choice, so that's that.
I mean, for example, leave the office early. Leave at 4 or 4:30 p.m. Yeah, if your boss lets you, that's the deal.
Yeah, no, and if you've got to have some kind of control about it. And if you do have, you know, an entrepreneurial sort of company, it's a pleasure to work for, or for yourself, indeed, you can make these choices, but I don't. What does your calendar look like, Doug? Tell me what your calendar looks like.
What do you mean? Like when I do this things?
I mean the next article, which is called "What My Calendar Looks Like."
Oh, sorry, it's too late at night for me to get subtlety. So this is Jason Fried, who's Fried. Jess, I'm gonna call him Jason Fried, as if he's deep fried. Fried Jason.
Yeah, I go for Fried.
Okay, so he is CEO of Basecamp. Yeah, it used to be called 37 Signals, then they rebranded to just Basecamp, which is, for those who haven't used it, is like a project management online app. And this is a great article. And he says, whenever I'm at a coffee shop, I walk by people with their laptops open and their calendar, and I see something like this. And it's basically loads of calendars and loads of things going on all different days.
Yeah.
And he says it looks a bit like Tetris, trying to fit in all the different things. Then he says, here's my calendar. And it's like empty most days and the occasional like half an hour meeting or whatever.
Yep.
And he says, I always leave Mondays open and da, da, da. And what do I do with all that empty space? I do my job. I design, I write, I think, I work. So there we are.
Yeah, no, that's fabulous. Okay, but so I run a jigsaw piece calendar, and which looks like his first picture, more or less. And it sends me my agenda at 7 o'clock every morning. Thank you very much of the things that I've got to do. It includes my lessons, includes the pupils' prep, which I don't need to do. I've already done that and planned it more or less, and I know when they're coming. But I still have it there, so just so that I think through my day and the shit, don't be
Yeah, and you know, everything that goes on a company blog, and this has had 1,900 shares and likes and whatever,
yeah.
Everything is marketing, isn't it? So this is like, we're not the company who are grinding stuff out. There's another post where he talks about, or one of his colleagues talks about, how we're not trying to like drain the last drop out of every single thing. Like, they're trying to position themselves as a human company. I think they work, apart from their support people, I think they do 4 days a week. And that's great, and I admire that. But my going back to that deep work book, one of the things that Cal Newport talks about is the fact that you kind of need to structure. He cites a book which I actually randomly had been reading bits and pieces of from 1924 or something, which is it's Arnold Bennett, and it's How to Live on 24 Hours a Day.
Yes, I remember talking about it somewhere.
Yeah, and so what he's saying is you've got 8 hours of work, but you've also got 16 hours. Okay, you need to sleep, but you've got these 16 hours. And so Cal Newport picks up on this and says, well, what you need to do is instead of, you know, being very disciplined in your 8-hour workday or whatever it is, you also need to be disciplined and have a structure for what you're doing with your free time, which sounds very boring. But if you don't do that, you just end up endlessly scrolling through Twitter and Facebook and Pinterest and stuff, and your time just disappears. And it's not actually, not only is it not a very good use of your time, it's actually psychologically not very good for you.
No, I would concur with that. However, I do think there's a need to have some unstructured time somewhere. So I have a thing. I don't really have much to do with time when I'm working because there's not very much of it to play with. But in the holidays and things, when I have lots of time to play with, I make sure that I do certainly for a run. What I do realise I'm bad at is doing my own personal administration, so dealing with my post and my bills and, you know, driving licences and things like that. You know, I'm not very good at that sort of thing. I just never get round to it. But so I could do with some more structure in that regard.
Well, I've been busier this week than I have been for a while, and we know we had a quick chat before we started recording about, you know, how crazy the life of a teacher can be in terms of time. And I've certainly never been busier than I was when I was teaching in my 20s. But there's a bit in one of the Stoic philosophers where it says that you kind of need to keep busy because otherwise you need to be focused on things that are important, because otherwise you end up with too much introspection. And you end up questioning your life and what you're doing, all that kind of stuff. And I'm prone to that kind of stuff anyway. Uh-huh. And so I find that actually having to get stuff done, not all the time, but having a week of it is actually pretty good for my mental health. Because it's like, come on, Doug, you can totally do this. And when you manage to do it, you feel great.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? It's like when you train for something and then you hit a crunch point, like maybe for some people, it's not for me because I don't do it, but some competitive run like a marathon or something. And for me, I play football twice a week, and I'm quite conscious of the fact that how I handle myself, how I eat, how I sleep, how I exercise when I'm not playing football affects how I play when I play football sometimes. And it's that idea of being able to put your A game in. Do you know what I mean? And so that's a conversation I have with myself is, how can I bring my A game? And how I all of the time. And some, as you say, I'll have a week where, it's just masses of juggling and pushing and working hard and working well, but working incredibly quickly. And if you work like that all of the time, but it's good sometimes to do that, even though it's usually forced upon you rather than chosen. Do you know what I mean?
No, definitely. And I think that making little changes to make that happen is really good. So one thing that I haven't mentioned is that I have released... Oh, what's happening here?
I don't know. You're fine from my point.
No, sorry. My website seemed to be sending me to some spam link or something. Anyway, I've released chapter 3 of my audiobook, which is called Upping Your Game, A Practical Guide to Personal Productivity, version 2. And what I'm focusing on there oh, my website has totally been owned.
You're joking.
Seriously. It's now redirecting to spam offers and stuff. Wait. I'll have to sort that out. But what I'm trying to get at with exercise is, like, you know, you talked about...
Which website? Hang on, which website?
DougBelshaw.com/blog.
Oh, your blog. Okay, let's see. Blog. Remember, that's blog.
Yeah. It's redirecting to, top offers and stuff.
Okay. Mm. So look, while we're here, live, watching.
Great. Let's laugh at Doug's misfortune.
Oh gosh, yeah. It's not loading properly. I've got some images though. Star Wars image.
Yeah, but it's not doing it properly, and then it'll redirectly to all kinds of stuff. I wonder how that's happened. I will sort it out. So that's something I didn't need today. Right, well, I'm gonna stop there and just ask you, there's a link there if people are interested, if we've got space to include it in the show notes, which is, if you want to earn more, work less, which kind of goes with this whole productivity thing and being laser focused and not just doing busy work. But I'll just finish by asking you what you're up to in the next week.
I'm just finishing a report cycle, so I did a long tutorial today, so I'll be writing pastoral reports over the next couple of days. I'm finishing off controlled assessments, so I'm not doing anything out of the ordinary. Just teaching digital strategy stuff, doing the one-to-one, getting the devices in that I saw at BET so we can distribute devices around teachers ready for after half term, which comes at the end of whenever. I can't even
cool.
How about you?
Well, Force 9, I'm in Jersey at the moment and I'm working at the school tomorrow, but Force 9 gales are forecast for the island, which means the chances of me leaving this rock are slim tomorrow, so I might be staying in Jersey next night. Then on Monday, I'm flying to Geneva, like I mentioned, doing Safer Internet Day, flying back Tuesday night. I am finalising a potential three-legged Canada trip at the end of April, start of May. Calgary's confirmed, so is Toronto. I've just got to see if I can get into Vancouver. And then I'm having a conversation about potential badgering in Nairobi and... just doing the usual stuff.
Nairobi, Kenya.
Yeah.
Interested to hear about that. Brilliant. Okay. Well, you need to go fix your website. So have a good week if you're listening, and you have a good website fix, Doug.
Thank you. I'm going to need it. Cheers, Di.
Take care. Bye
bye. Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay.